Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Two Shot.
Oh, my nose.
Yes, it's the podcast where bad things happen. My name is William Bibbiani.
And good things, too.
My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a film critic for The Rap and Bloody Disgusting, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. It's 2020, and I'm the new Whitney Seibold.
Ooh, fancy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm still eating as badly, and I'm not exercising, and I'm drinking as much caffeine as I always did, but...
Now you've got more tetrahydrozoline.
Yes. I did a sit-up today. Took me all morning.
In a couple of years, you'll have an ab.
Just one.
But it'll be great.
It'll be on my elbow.
Hey, everybody. Thank you very, very much for joining us on this, the last episode of The Two Shot.
We're so sorry.
Yeah. A lot of changes have been in motion here at what is now the Movie House Podcast Network. Ryan Snelling is taking this whole thing in another direction, and we thought now would be a good time to exit gracefully and take all of our projects to our own podcast feed, the critically acclaimed network. Some people surmised that the Two Shot would be moving to the critically acclaimed network, and we did consider it.
We did consider it, but the Two Shot is... We love it. We actually do love the Two Shot.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
The some of the pairings we've come up with, I think, have been kind of ingenious.
Mm-hmm.
Pairing Caddyshack 2 with The Rules of the Game was one of my favorites.
Pairing Jingle All the Way with Bicycle Thieves, easily my favorite.
Yeah, yeah.
Easily. Because they're finding out those are the same film, that was quite an experience.
Holy crap. Like, to this day, I'm curious. And if I ever get the screenwriters, like, in a room, I'm going to ask, when you wrote Jingle All the Way, were you thinking of Bicycle Thieves? Like, were you just trying to sandwich in this story into this...
It's really on the nose.
Weird
it's
comedy weird. Whose tone I can't figure out.
But yeah, this show started off as an adjunct to Critically Acclaimed, the podcast that is now on the Critically Acclaimed Network. And we decided to split them off into their own separate things. And as time went on, Whitney and I, as podcast hosts, entrepreneurs, creative individuals, we had some other ideas we wanted to explore, but we only have so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
So we figured the Two Shot is the thing that most organically has a reason to expire for a while.
Especially right now when there's all this like reworking going on and restructuring and all the rest. I know a lot of our beloved peers are, they're not hard up. These people are going to find work because they're all talented and amazing, but they're out in the marketplace right now.
Yeah.
And so we figured we'd just sort of, in a weird sense of solidarity, I suppose.
It makes sense. Now it seems like the moment.
Coinciding, this just seemed like good timing.
So this episode on The Two Shot, we are going to be reviewing all of the Police Academy movies because you voted for it and we promised and we watched them all and by God, we have to have this conversation. But in the future, we will be at the Critically Acclaimed Network with the currently existing shows on that network and a new one. Mm-hmm. And that is our big announcement. It's not that The Two Shot is ending. It's that The Two Shot is going to not turn into something else, but it's going to make room for something else. So in addition to all the other shows of the Critically Acclaimed Network, there's Critically Acclaimed, where we review new movies and also do we're currently doing the Best of the Year and Best of the Decade lists over there. In addition to We've Got Mail, where we answer your mail. In addition to Canceled Too Soon, where we review TV shows that lasted only one season or less. And in addition to all of the exclusive Patreon stuff we have at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we do Star Trek podcasts and Oscars podcasts and a ton of other stuff besides, we were like, hey, let's do another one. If you may recall earlier, like during the Christmas break, if you follow me on Twitter, I had a tweet and a lot of people responded, no, don't do it. Because they were worried about my mental health, adding another thing to my workload. But I tweeted that I had a really good idea for a Star Wars podcast.
And the world needs another Star Wars podcast like it needs a hole in the head. But
well, ironically, we need several holes in our head in order to survive.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
Also, I've heard that trepanning can actually give you a feeling of... like a delirious kind of ecstasy.
Euphoria is what
euphoria, that was the word I was looking for.
I don't know if I'm going to support trepanning, but okay.
I've seen a few documentaries on trepanning because I'm fascinated by it.
Okay, we're going to move on from trepanning. It is not a trepanning podcast.
Ah, rats. That's my next idea. William, keep shooting it down.
But in any case, I had an idea for a Star Wars podcast that it's a subject people have talked about before, but to the best of my knowledge, no one had ever done a whole podcast about it. And I ran it by Whitney, and much to my surprise, he was like, that's a good idea. And this is, we're not the biggest Star Wars nerds ever, so like the idea that we would both be really, really excited about a Star Wars podcast is pretty cool. So starting in the next week or two, we need to iron out some details. We're going to have a new Star Trek, Star Wars podcast.
Star Wars podcast. It's going to be really confusing because now we're going to have a Star Trek podcast and a Star Wars podcast.
Damn it.
So on the Star Wars podcast, the Star Trek Enterprise was flying to Battlestar Galactica.
In any case, our new Star Wars podcast, which we are currently just debating between two different titles. Mm. One is called Before the Wars, and the other is called Let the Past Live. Podcast it if you have to. That's in parentheses. Mm. We would do a Star Wars podcast in which we talk about all of the movies that influenced Star Wars. One per episode. Yeah.
Not necessarily Star Wars itself, although that's sort of the cultural pivot point,
that's
which we're going to be going back to. Star Wars changed a lot when it came out, not just in terms of technicals and, you know, film business, but the way a lot of fantasy storytelling started to be used by major filmmakers and everyone thereafter. Mm-hmm. And so it is, yeah, really kind of a really important cultural marker, no matter how you feel about it or what it's become today or whether or not you love or hate it. We do have to acknowledge all of the gigantic changes that happened and all of the things that sort of led up to it.
Yeah, Star Wars was kind of a pastiche.
Yeah, it was
in a lot of ways.
It wasn't an inevitable thing, but it's interesting to see how all of the things that influenced the people that made it sort of fed into this thing and how they were distilled, changed, mutated, if you will, into something like Star Wars, and how that has become the new cultural touchstone for the last 40 years.
You can learn an astonishing amount about film history and indeed the cultural history of the 20th century by looking at the various films. We're mostly going to be looking at films that directly inspired Star Wars.
Yeah.
Not just like a little bit, like maybe we'll do a couple of those, but if they're fun, but really looking at the films that George Lucas very clearly touched on in order to make Star Wars the film that it is. Mm-hmm. This probably won't be an unlimited series. I don't know if we can get 500 episodes out of that, but we're going to do a sizable number until we feel like the subject has been basically covered. And then if people like that, maybe we'll move on to another film and look at the various cultural touchstones that led to another popular work of fiction. Mm-hmm. I really like the idea of using popular contemporary cinema as a means to teach people about older cinema that they might not otherwise be aware of or appreciate or understand the context of.
Yeah.
So
like, these are things people know because of Star Wars tangentially. Mm-hmm. You might have heard a title. Mm-hmm. You might even like be so familiar with Star Wars imagery, you don't realize that it actually is a direct pastiche to something that came before it.
Right.
We're here to illuminate all of that, to elucidate.
So that will be coming up on the critically acclaimed network. That will be free. That is not subscription only on our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. That will be available for all, and we're going to debut that within the next couple of weeks. But for now, it is time to get to the franchise that killed the two-shot.
It didn't kill that
two-shot. This is the one. This was the straw that broke the back. This was the final blow. This is the Police Academy movies. Whitney, what is your weird history with the Police Academy movies?
Well, the Police Academy movies were hugely popular, and they were very important, and they were huge hits, most of them. I think the first five, anyway. I think only the sixth and seventh weren't gigantic hits. Mm-hmm. But when a lot of people...
Seventh barely got released.
Yeah, barely got it. I know it was released overseas, because I was overseas when it was released.
Yeah.
But when people talk about, like, 1980s nostalgia, they talk about nostalgia for the kinds of genres that we're still making today. Fantasy films. Mm-hmm. You know, your Ghostbusters, your Gremlins, your Backs to the
Action
Future.
Movies is
yeah,
sometimes
action movies, your Beverly
Fast
Hills
and
Cop,
Furious is Bonds.
Maybe all that. But the biggest business in the 1980s were the comedies, and those aren't things that we seem to be having a lot of nostalgia for. Maybe a Caddyshack here and there.
Well, and again, if there's crossover, like Ghostbusters, for example, definitely a comedy.
It's a comedy, but it has the fantasy elements, and I think that's what people are kind of really leaning into. It's not... Can you imagine a Ghostbusters film about the Ghostbusters, but there's no ghosts in it? Like they're trying to start they're trying to start a bakery.
Well, you look at, again, I've only seen the trailer for Jason Reitman's updated reboot, whatever, of Ghostbusters, but Paul Feig's version, take away any of the other aspects of it, leaned into the comedy part.
Yeah.
They thought it was Ghostbusters was a comedy. You look at the trailer for the next Ghostbusters movie, the Jason Reitman one. Mm. There's almost no comedy in it.
Yeah.
They clearly think the mythology is what people really, really exactly. care about. It's so, interesting to see two very different ideas based on the exact same movies.
So, there's not a lot of nostalgia for 3 Men and a Baby, which was the highest grossing film of 1987. I love to go back to that fact because it seems baffling
these
days.
It's so weird. And there were big movies that year.
Yeah. Nobody talks about Look Who's Talking. Mm-hmm. And nobody talks about the Police Academy series, which started in 1984 and ended in 1994. Mm-hmm. 7 films over the course of a decade.
One a year for most of that time.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The last two were kind of late entries, from what I understand.
That was 1984 through 1989. There was one a year, and then they took a 5-year break and came back for the last one.
Yeah.
That's insanity.
That's crazy.
That's a really fast clip. And yeah, they're cheapo,
and,
like, comedy movies, but it's only since then, the only two franchises I can remember that did that were Paranormal Activity and Saw, and those were also mega cheap, genre films. Yeah.
So, this idea that, and when I was a kid, that's all I watched. I loved the comedies that came out when I was a kid. I was watching comedy films, even the bad, well, mostly just bad ones because I was a kid. I had no taste.
Fair enough.
I was very fond of Hot to Trot when I was a kid.
I haven't seen Hot to Trot since I was a kid.
Yeah, maybe don't go back.
Okay.
Yeah, if you're fond of it as a kid, just leave it in that hazy halcyon
area. I used to confuse it with Let It Ride, but Let It Ride is genuinely a comedy classic.
Oh, yeah.
If you haven't seen Let It Ride, it's hilarious.
Who made Let It Ride? Somebody notable.
Oh, who did direct that? Yeah. I remember it starred Richard Dreyfuss, and he played a gambler who promised his girlfriend/fiancée, Terry Garr, that he would give up gambling. But as soon as he does, his best friend, who drives a taxi, overhears two guys in the back seat rigging a horse race. So it's a sure thing. And he's like, well, it's not gambling if it's a sure thing, right? So he decides to bet one last gamble. He'll make money. It'll be for the wedding. It'll be great. And then he wins. And then he goes up to the guys and he actually thanks them, which is really kind of a stupid move. And he's like, hey, listen, I'm not going to say anything. I just want to say thanks for rigging that. They really helped me out a lot. And they're like, oh, okay. Little big boy in the fifth. What?
No!
And then for one day, he can't stop gambling, but he also can't stop winning. Which shouldn't be funny. It is. Somehow it's really funny to watch him not be able to stop winning, no matter how hard he tries.
The director of Let It Ride was Joe Pitka, who's a name I only know because he also did one of the worst movies ever made. He did Space Jam, and those are his only two films.
The director of Space Jam directed one of my favorite movies.
Yes. Let It Ride and Space Jam were both made by Joe
Pitka.
How
did I not know that? That's insanity to me.
Yeah.
Because Space Jam is one of my least favorite movies. That's a weird career. Anyway,
to the comedies of the 1980s, they hold a dear place in my heart just as I grew up watching them. And I watched the Police Academy movies a lot, the first three in particular. I feel like Police Academy 3, Back in Training. For a brief period, I think that was 1986 that one came out.
Yeah.
For a brief period, that was my favorite movie. Because I was a kid.
Adorable scamp.
I didn't get a lot of the off-colored humor, but I did get a lot of the slapstick. So, and I appreciated the slapstick, and I liked the characters, and I thought Bob Goldthwait was one of the funniest things, and I loved his...
Bob Goldthwait is interplay
with Tim Kazurinsky, and...
I'm going to say this right now. Bob Goldthwait isn't the MVP of the franchise. I do think he's the funniest person in it.
He's the most consistently funny.
Because he gets consistent laughs every time he's on screen.
He's doing his shtick, and I love that Bob Goldthwait, who admittedly was struggling with drugs at the time and was using the Police Academy movies to sort of fuel his bad habits, has come to complete peace with kind of the weird, dark cultural spot these films represent.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though I loved them, at the time they were derided for their stupidity.
Every critic hated these. Like, I remember, was it Leonard Maltin who said, if they make another one of these, I'll quit?
Maybe so.
some major film critic said, if they make one more Police Academy movies, I'm out. And they did, and the producers were like, you balls in your court. These were massively unpopular to everyone except the people who bought tickets.
it's like the Transformers movies. Everybody hated them except for the millions of people who see them.
And they weren't the biggest hits ever. They just always made a profit.
Yeah. There was a joke about them in Wayne's World, if you recall. There was a bit where Cassandra says some sort of... if a frog had wings, he would bump his ass when he hopped. And Wayne is a little taken aback by the frankness of that phrase. Interesting. Where did you learn English?
College.
College. and the Police Academy movies.
I looked for that line in the Police Academy movies, and I didn't hear it.
It's not in the Police Academy movies.
That's very disappointing.
Just, she learned, if she learned English watching Police Academy movies, that's the kind there's of like a little bit of, not much class in those movies.
Well, we're going to talk about what we each think now are the best of the Police Academy movies. My short history of Police Academy movies was, I watched them in the 80s, I thought some of them were funny. The one thing I do remember very distinctly about the 1980s, and I was young at the time, I was born in 82, was the idea that the Police Academy archetypes, these very specific characters, had become kind of like universally recognized. Where kids knew about the funny sound effects guy.
Yeah,
and kids knew about the funny gun nut. And kids knew about the guy who talked like this. Mm. Like, we knew those guys. Even if we hadn't seen the movies, they'd become just famous weird comedy archetypes.
Cultural archetypes, yeah.
And indeed, the majority of the Police Academy movies was take these weird characters, put them in a situation, see what they do. Mm. There's not a lot of plot in most of these. The basic premise of Police Academy is a bunch of people go to a police academy to become police officers, and they're all mismatched weirdos.
The premise is the mayor of Metropolis.
It was Metro City, wasn't it?
They call it Metro City.
Yeah.
Which is not a real city.
But you have a theory that it's actually Metropolis.
My theory is it's Metropolis, and that would kind of excuse the fact that every police officer is horrible and can't take care of any kind of crimes, because if you're a cop in a place where Superman exists, then you probably don't need to work very hard. Superman is doing all the heavy lifting for you.
Yeah. There's a lot of room to pull pranks on each other if you're working in Metropolis. Like,
yeah, you're just, well, we need cops, I guess. I've always liked this theory. And yeah,
I've always liked the theory the Police Academy takes place in the Superman universe. Especially makes sense in, like, the Superman 3 and 4 universes, where everything's kind of wacky.
Comedic anyway.
Like, especially 3 with that huge weird opening sight gag sequence, which has nothing to do with Superman whatsoever. People are falling down manholes.
That could be in a Police Academy movie.
100% could.
The idea is the mayor has changed the law so that anyone can apply to be a police officer. Well, evidently, there were like...
They frame it in a weird way because the opening title scrawl, like Star Wars, for Police Academy, explains that, and this is really interesting because if they made this today, people would be complaining about how woke it is. There's a new, and they make a point of this, female mayor, who is almost never seen. I think we see her in like one scene in a sequel.
And I think she's in part 5.
Like really briefly, there's a really short moment.
And there's a new mayor in part 6.
Yeah. But there's a new female mayor, and she has decided that the rules for who can be a police officer are too discriminatory.
Which they
absolutely are. And so she says, now anyone can be a police officer, man or woman, and it doesn't matter what your gender is, it doesn't matter if you don't fit an arbitrary height requirement. And as a result, a lot of people who previously had no hope of ever being a police officer, all of a sudden the door is open for them and they decide to walk through it. So it's all about a group of wildly disparate, totally different people who decide to become police officers, and there's a whole bunch of wacky hijinks they get into at this school, while everyone at the top, you know, the assholes and racists, decide they're going to do everything they can to get all of these people to quit. Because if they fail them, they could argue that it's the institution that's the problem. If we get these people to quit, then we prove that our discriminatory practices were right and true to begin with. And indeed, there's a lot of humor, especially in the first one, about a bunch of white people at this police academy being horribly racist, and then looking over their shoulder and seeing Bubba Smith, who's this giant actor.
He's a football player.
Yeah. And he just looking down at them just sort of vaguely threateningly, and then just like, the guy's just like, oh, there sure are a lot of, insert expletive here, at this police academy. The guy looks at Bubba Smith, and he's like, which is great! I thoroughly support this!
Hooks is the brunt of a particularly ugly racist word that I hadn't heard outside of like literature of the 20s and 30s.
Yeah. I think that's how they tried to take the sting off of it by making it really dated. Maybe, but it's still bad.
Maybe so. It's really bad. But yeah, it uses a really dated racist word. And I'm thinking, was that okay in 84? But realize that that's where a lot of kind of the central theme of the movie comes from, because the villain says it. And we get to see his motivation right in that moment. He says a racist word right to a woman of color, and we say, wait a minute, okay, this is not about protecting the institution, as they've said all this time. This is about racism.
Yeah.
This is now explicitly about racism.
Right. What's interesting to me is that although it is explicitly about racism and overcoming racism, there's a ton of sexism and homophobia in it. Like a ton. Like a metric ton of both of those things.
Yeah.
Okay, so the cast includes Steve Guttenberg, who plays a ne'er-do-well. How often do well?
Ne'er.
Yeah. I love that joke. I didn't write that. It's such a great joke. But he's like the grandson or someone, or the son of a former police detective. And as a result, he's been given kind of infinite free passes for every time he breaks the law. And now this guy, who's like his godfather.
A slacker and a layabout. And
yeah, and this guy is... Yeah,
Steve Guttenberg, because of these movies and because of the success of 3 Men and a Baby, got no end of shit from the comic community. He was seen as this kind of wimpy, nothing presence who only did these kind of cheap, easy comedies.
Well, and on top of it
all... In the fourth two, and he's checked out by then. But in the first three, he's committed to playing this kind of really a charming ne'er-do-well. He actually does have charm. He actually is a bit of an agent of chaos, and I appreciate it.
At least in the first three. I'm not even sure about the first three. First one, okay. But so the whole plot is he is told by his, I think it's his godfather or his dad's best friend or whatever, that I can't get you off the hook for crimes anymore. So from now on, you have two options. Either you go to jail, which you will because you did it. And it was an act of rebellion against a rich jerk who
insults his face.
Yeah, and he wrecked the guy's car, but not too bad. And it's just, you'll either go to jail for all the crimes you do, or you go to police academy. And my one rule is they can flunk you, but you can't quit.
Yeah, he's not allowed to quit.
So his whole mission is to get flunked out of police academy and be as terrible as he possibly can. But what he doesn't realize is all the higher ups have a rule that they can't flunk anybody. They all have to quit. So he's the only, he's like Jack Nicholson at the end of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He's the only one who's completely screwed, and it's all his own fault. And I kind of appreciated that as a plot point.
Yeah, the police academy is run by Captain Harris. I guess it's run by the Commandant.
It's run by Commandant Lessard, who is played by...
George Gaines.
George Gaines, who is... In the first couple of movies, he's just a slightly befuddled old man who typically means well.
Turns into Grandpa Simpson.
Yeah, in the later films, he becomes very broadly comedic. And I actually think it's a good move. I think he's a better character when he does.
He becomes, like, kinder and gentler as the films go on.
I actually have some nice things to say about the later Police Academy movies, but we're going to get there.
I don't.
I do. But the actual day-to-day operations are run by the great G.W. Bailey, who played this role a lot. He played the, stern a-hole who makes life miserable for cool people, often Steve Guttenberg. You may remember him from Short Circuit, where he played this role, and he just wanted to kill that robot. You remember him from Mannequin.
Where he played the security guard.
Yeah, who they couldn't get Steve Guttenberg for Mannequin, so they got Andrew McCarthy. That's totally a Steve Guttenberg movie. He would have done that.
You know what? And Andrew McCarthy totally could have played Kerry Mahoney. They were he was a little too... I think
maybe a little young.
A little young, but they're about the same age.
Yeah. Pretty close.
They fulfilled a very particular type of comedic archetype from the 1980s. That sort of shiftless yet charming, vaguely sexy layabout.
Yeah. So he is taking it upon himself to make the lives of everyone at the Police Academy miserable. In the first film, we don't meet all of the major characters that will run throughout the Police Academy in the first film, but we meet a lot of them.
Well, first of all, Mahoney gets there and he immediately starts sliming all over Kim Cattrall, and this is the only film Kim Cattrall will be in.
In this series.
Kim Cattrall, also in Mannequin.
Yeah, there you go. Kim Cattrall is one of my favorite actors of the 1980s. I grew up watching her movies all the time. And here she just wants to be a policewoman. There's a line where she says, someone asks her why she wants to be a policewoman, and they don't say police officer, they say policewoman. She's very adamant about it. And there's a line where someone asks her, she says, I like to wear men's clothes. And I'm just that's cool.
I like to dress like a man.
Yeah. All right, that's cool. Okay, I'm glad we're dealing with this. But all of that sort of kind of progressive, kind of just like interesting, is kind of undermined by the first time she meets Mahoney. He's standing behind her as everyone's standing at attention.
Or he's pretending to be the captain.
And he is sexually harassing her in a really ugly way. And then they end up together. That is not how that works. People don't usually fall charmingly in love with their sexual harassers.
In the 1980s, that kind of aggressive sexual harassment was seen as flirting. And when a young woman is charmed by this handsome young man and, you know, flattered by his attention, she's willing to forgive the fact that it was sexual harassment. Uh-huh. That's the way it functioned in 80s comedies.
That, by the way, I don't think that's how it actually functioned in the 80s. I think that's just how the men who made 80s comedies wanted it to be.
Yeah, they
put it in 80s comedies.
Well, they wanted sort of a caddish moment that was a little lascivious, but was also a little bit fun. The problem was it wasn't a little bit fun, and it doesn't play as a little bit fun anymore. But yeah, he says, show me your thighs, Lieutenant, and she's a little bit taken aback and then realizes, wait a minute, you're not the captain.
Yeah.
We're asking to doggle my thighs. Screw you, buddy.
And then the next scene they have together is her flirting with him.
Yeah, yeah.
What? Anyway, some of the other people we meet Cadet Larvell Jones, a.k.a. Jonesy, played by Michael Winslow, the comedian who has only one bit.
Well, that's his shtick, isn't it? He is a very good vocal percussionist and vocal special effects.
Yeah, he can make almost any noise just using his mouth, and he uses that in every movie to trick people into thinking they hear things that they didn't hear.
It's not necessarily a good shtick for a whole series of comedies. That's like a good bit on Saturday Night Live or a good bit for stand-up.
Indeed,
not just Michael Winslow, but most of the cast were from the world of stand-up.
Right.
A lot of these people were stand-up comedians, and indeed, in the 1980s, there was a gigantic comedy boom. Comedy clubs were opening everywhere. The market was flooded with stand-up comedians, and many of them were getting sitcoms. And a lot of people entered stand-up comedy with the express purpose of getting a sitcom or a movie.
Right.
So this was a big dream come true for a lot of these people.
Yeah.
They had their bit, they did it on stage, and then they were cast as a funny archetype in a big hit comedy film.
Yeah.
So, and Michael Winslow has been the most loyal to the series. He was in all of the movies, and I think he was one of the only cast members to go over to the live-action sitcom that followed.
I think he was only in, like, a short bit of it. Like, he did, like a couple of guest spots on it.
But he was in it.
He was in it, to his credit. I was watching all the Police Academy movies, and I was finding Michael Winslow's bit getting a little old. And then my wife and partner, Michelle, actually reframed it in a really great way, where it's not just one gag. He's a reverse mime. He only works in sound. Mm-hmm. And when I started thinking about him in that terms, I was like, look at how they turned one piece of shtick into a million comic bits. And yeah, most of them aren't funny, but they're all different. Like, I actually started to admire the difficulty in keeping Michael Winslow's character relevant over seven films. And the fact that he's there at all and has anything to do by the seventh, I'm sort of like, okay, good on you, Michael Winslow, and the writers of Police Academy. You actually, you overcame an obstacle. I'm not sure I needed you to, but good for you.
Well, and he also has a bit of a character. He's a bit of a kook, and like Mahoney's sort of like devil may care attitude.
Eventually, they add that he's a kung fu master, which I actually appreciated because it gave him more to do.
Yeah, he actually got to do something during the very, very, very perfunctory action climaxes that each of these films have.
let's see what we got here. We have Eugene Tackleberry, played by the late, great David Graff.
David Graff is so dang good in these movies.
He's one
committed.
Of the better people. Yeah, he is. A lot of people are really committed to this. David Graff plays the paranoid gun nut, which was a funnier character in the 80s than it is now.
And it was funny in the 90s, too, but only when it's Burt Gummer. Nobody else can get away with this.
Or David Graff, I guess. But David Graff, like, he's obsessed with guns. He's obsessed with security. His whole thing is, when he gets to be a police officer, it's just like, when do we get the guns? And, like, when they go through, like, a training course, he's the one who's doing backflips over things because he's been, like, preparing to be in this commando sequel his entire life.
He brings his own gun to the shooting range.
It's actually really incredible to me how they managed to take this character who I think any other comedy franchise would have at least touched more on the darker side of and keep him really light. He is well-intentioned and nice. He just really likes guns and shooting things.
You know, there's no, like, some dark element to his past. Oh, yes, I was tied to a radiator in Vietnam or something.
And he's not, like, you know, there was this cliche of, like, the urban warrior who was, like, really terrified of the communists running into their town.
Yeah.
That's not a thing. That's not even a thing in Mission to Moscow.
He is a violence enthusiast. That's it.
But never against the wrong people.
No.
It's just interesting. It's amazing that they get away with this character. I actually give him a lot of credit for it.
He has a really, really wonderful romance in the second film with Colleen Camp.
Ah.
Where he runs into another gun nut. And the way they communicate, yeah, it's just really wonderful.
She's really, really funny. So we have Marion Ramsey as Laverne Hooks, a character who has only one bit, but it always works for me. She's very soft-spoken.
She's small. She has a very small voice. Nobody listens to her. She's always very flustered until the breaking point that happens within a few seconds.
Yeah, there's always at least one scene.
Scream people down all of a sudden.
When she actually breaks and starts screaming and loses her shit, it's usually really, really funny. Like, because she sold the bit. Mm-hmm. You believed that she was a very meek, calm-voiced, tiny, personality person.
Put your ass on the seats and listen on!
And then you're like, oh, God, Jesus!
Okay. And then she's, that's a lot better.
Always works. Mm. So the plot of the first one is they're trying to kick everybody out. Everybody's trying to get kicked out. Mm. Oh, we forgot Fackler, by the way.
Oh, Fackler.
Played by Bruce Mahler, who is the most accident-prone human ever. Mm.
And some of his physical comedy is sublime. I think he has a bit in the sixth movie that is worthy of Harold Lloyd, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, everywhere he goes, disaster follows. And indeed, the opening scene where we see him leaving to go to the police academy, and his wife, who will eventually join the police academy in a future episode, she tries to stop him because she knows it's a terrible idea. And he goes away in his car, and she does that whole Ferris Bueller running from backyard to backyard shtick.
And ends up landing on the hood of his car.
And then he drives all the way to the police academy with her on the hood of his car and somehow not noticing. And there's everyone else is driving to the police academy at the same time, and they just drive past Fackler's car. They're like, what the fuck?
What's his name? Martin.
Oh, yeah.
And Andrew Rubin plays George Martin, who's only in this film, and he's the womanizer. He has multiple girlfriends. He shows up in a big convertible with a bunch of women in the convertible saying, oh, well, bye, girls. I'm off to be a policeman. And they're like, aw. And he's the one who sneaks into the woman's dorm. Mm. And he's the one who ends up being kind of sexually overwhelmed by Callahan, played by another star of this series, Leslie Easterbrook.
Who's in most of them. I think she takes the next one or two off. But Leslie Easterbrook is this very tall, very athletic, very stern police academy teacher who is also... People find her very sexually intimidating, and it's very funny most of the time.
Yeah,
because she's the one actually who has the power in that situation.
She has every single scrap of sexual agency in this movie.
Yeah.
She wields her body like a weapon. I think that's in the script.
Yeah.
And she does it very well, and I think she's very funny, and she always plays the role to the hilt.
I actually appreciate her more in the later ones, because the later ones give her more to do. As we start losing main cast members like Bubba Smith and Steve Guttenberg, everyone else starts getting more to do, and that actually really benefits Leslie Easterbrook in particular, because she's clearly got her shit together. She knows everything. She's teaching everyone everything. She almost never gets to actually do anything cool.
If she wants a boyfriend, she'll grab one.
She just takes them. She's like Grace Jones and Conan the Destroyer. If you want a man, you take him.
Very much.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that she selected Brian Tochi, because he is the butt of so many racist jokes in Police Academy 3.
Yeah.
This comes from an era when it was just okay to make fun of Asian people.
Yeah.
It's just okay. Every mainstream comedy.
And of course, it was never okay.
An Asian person stepped on camera and you heard a gong sound effect. That's where we were. And then, as late as the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And he's into Eastern mysticism and martial arts, because we know nothing else about Asian people. And yet, Leslie Easterbrook steps forward and says, yeah, him.
Yeah.
And gives him all of this sexual attention, and I have respect for him through Leslie Easterbrook in a weird way.
Anyway, the plot of the first one is a whole bunch of wacky shit happens.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit where G.W. Bailey enlists the two racists who joined up to the police academy.
Oh, yeah.
To stalk everyone and make their lives a living hell. At one point, they end up being tricked into going to the Blue Oyster Bar, which is basically the bar from Scorpio Rising.
It's a gay leather bar.
but a very aggressive one, and they end up being forced to dance all night, slow style, with a bunch of really, really butch bikers.
It's a gay leather bar, but there's no sex going on there. It's not like in Cruising.
Yeah. At least not that we see.
I suppose not. It's just all night tango. So if you get locked into the Blue Oyster, which happens to a lot of the straight guys, and there's a lot of gay panic.
Like in the first like four movies, yeah. There's one scene where they just randomly some guy gets just like, oh, we gotta duck in here real fast, and it's the Blue Oyster Bar.
Yeah. And they're playing the same tango piece every time as well, if you notice.
And the, there's a scene in the first Police Academy, and for me, this is the scene that makes the first Police Academy just so gross I can't even, like, really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
They are trying to, the two racists are trying to get one of the Police Academy guys kicked out for having a woman in the men's dorm. By the way, these are all adults. Like, it's so weird that that's, like, a thing. But anyway, so they hire a sex worker to be in his room and to tempt him. And then the D.W. Bailey will come in and be like, what is this? And then they'll kick him out. Mahoney catches wind of this and decides to grab the woman and move her somewhere else. And he decides to say that, like, no, you're not working for him. You're working for I have the money, whatever, like that. So she follows him. And they end up hiding underneath a podium. And that's when Commandant Lassard comes in to give a presentation at the podium. And the sex worker goes, all right. And so while he is giving a slideshow presentation...
She's in the podium performing a sex act, yeah.
Yeah. And so he's trying to... Without having any idea who is doing this or what is going on, pretend that nothing is happening. And, of course, that's supposed to be funny and not sexual assault. And when it's all done, because Mahoney was stuck in there with her...
So he's up close watching that, I guess.
It's awkward for everyone. He only sees Mahoney stick his head out. And so he goes, oh. And so he's very confused about his own sexuality for, like, the second half of the movie. And then at the end...
And then Mahoney rolls with it because he wants to get kicked out. So he just says, good speech.
Yeah.
It's like, and then ducks back inside the podium.
Yeah. So we're playing off of a lot of homophobic ideas here. And then what's weird is at the end, the resolution to this whole awkward and uncomfortable and really gross subplot... is Commandant Lassard sees Mahoney making out with Kim Cattrall, and he says, good for you, Mahoney, as if you've cured yourself.
of your gayness. And I'm just your like... Your need to fillet old men from podium.
I'm like, what the fuck, Police Academy? That's really nothing to enjoy in that. Like, that's really just gross.
Here's the weird thing about Police Academy. Maybe it's in my blood. Maybe it's my age. Maybe I'm an asshole.
I think that's quite possible.
It's quite possible. But I'm watching these movies. I'm acknowledging every little bit of just every insult to humanity. Whether you're gay or straight, no matter what your race or your age, no matter your size or your height, this film is going to make fun of you. In fact, that's true of the most of the series. Gets a little more kid-friendly as we go along, but it's true. It's definitely true of the first one. And yet, I find their utter gall to be kind of funny. I'm laughing like a complete asshole at the first three Police Academy movies.
Are you laughing at everything?
Not at everything.
Okay, no,
there are plenty of gross jokes, but I'm still taken by a lot of the humor. Like just the style of the jokes and the timing of the comedy. I think it's still okay to laugh. Even as you acknowledge that these things are unbelievably backwards.
Sometimes I can say yes, sometimes I can't. There are parts of this first Police Academy, particularly in regarding to Mahoney, Kim Cattrall, and that whole
the podium bit
that I just don't find it funny. I think it's in poor taste. And not in a, well, it's in poor taste, but we're all having a good time, right? I wasn't. I found it unpleasant. But in any case, the first movie made tons of money. They all graduated from Police Academy after there was a big riot accidentally started by Fackler, and they all prove themselves, and they all become policemen.
Fackler doesn't want an apple. He throws it. It bonks on the head of some tough guy who spins around and sees another tough guy and just throws a punch immediately.
And pretty soon the entire city is fighting each other.
There was a bit that I liked when the riot was breaking out and things are actually getting kind of serious for the first time in the movie where... Mahoney runs, like, all the academy, they're all getting up in their riot gear. It's like, we need you all to suit up and put on your riot gear and go out and take care of this riot. Because they heard it over the loudspeaker. Previously in the movie, Jones had used the loudspeaker to commit an act of subterfuge and get, like, a teacher out of the room. Like, he talked into his little microphone and said, you're needed outside of the room in a different voice.
Yeah.
And I like the scene where Mahoney ran by Jones and says, was that you? And Jones is like putting on his Riker. Nope, not me, man. It's like, oh, he's like, oh shit,
it's real.
It's like, oh, this actually is serious, isn't it?
No, that's true. So the next year, we're back for another Police Academy. Police Academy 2, their first assignment, which is about their first assignment.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually out of the Police Academy. This isn't set in a Police Academy. They're actually just cops now, and they are sent to the worst precinct in town, which is run by Commandant Lassard's brother.
Yeah.
And that part of town has been completely overrun by a gang led by Bobcat Goldthwait.
Led by Zed.
Yeah.
Zed and his roughs rule the roost and are very violent and commit acts of vandalism and theft very openly and brazenly in the most amusing way possible.
There's a great bit in this movie
where they rob the grocery store. It's pretty hilarious.
That bit is great because they're robbing the grocery store and they're just treating it like their own personal amoral playground. And they're like, so there's like this one dweeby guy who's what's
Tim Kazurinsky.
Tim Kazurinsky, who plays
Sweet Chuck.
Mm. He runs a lamp store, and if you don't think that's going to be a source of a lot of calamity, a lamp store in a Police Academy movie, you've not been paying attention. Yeah, he like puts Sweet Chuck like in the produce and like piles it on top of him, and they're like shop, like they're stealing everything, but they're also shopping. And so he's like, nah, I'm watching my sweets. And they're all very polite to everybody as they're torturing everybody. That bit is actually comedy gold.
Okay.
Like, they're actually, like, just, I like that
just
the
good slapstick.
Well, I like that the villains in the First Police Academy were just evil racists.
Mm.
The villains in a lot of the other ones are actual hardened criminals.
Mm. We're going to get to Rene Auberjonois eventually.
Actually, I like Rene Auberjonois, but not just as an actor, but in these movies. I think he's funny. But this one, the bad guys, you could do a whole movie about that gang, and it would be the exact same tone as Police Academy.
Pretty much.
They're just funny bad guys. Mm. And I actually think that was a good tone to strike, where they're making everything really difficult for the cops, and so as a result, we have a movie. But they're not so cartoonishly evil or actually evil that it's not fun to watch them.
Mm.
So I think they strike a pretty good tone there.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And it makes sense because late in the film, when Mahoney goes undercover, you're able to buy that someone like Steve Guttenberg could infiltrate a gang.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Harris, previously played by G.W. Bailey, is out this time. He's replaced for parts 2 and 3 by essentially the same character, but it's Lieutenant Mauser.
Played by Art Metrano.
Art Metrano, who is... He's the same character.
He's doing G.W.
Really
Bailey.
The same character.
He's trying to take over the police precinct, and if he can make sure all of these new recruits fail at their jobs, he'll prove that the guy currently running it is incompetent, and he'll be able to run the police precinct.
And rather than
he's doing the same shtick.
Yeah, rather than having two racist underlings as his sidekick, he's given a bumbling sidekick in the form of Sergeant Proctor.
Sergeant Proctor, who will eventually just transfer over and be G.W. Bailey's sidekick later on with no explanation, which I think is really funny.
I have to say, a little bit of in the spirit of full disclosure, Lance Kinsey, who plays Sergeant Proctor, goes to my church.
Oh, okay. He's, that's funny. Right?
Like, he's not a close friend of mine, but I know him.
Okay, well, I'll speak up for Lance Kinsey. Lance Kinsey plays this like naive man-child of a character who just doesn't understand subtlety or subtext.
Going undercover as a sandwich maker. Okay, where are you doing? Well, the sandwiches aren't right yet, sir. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
The dinosaurs are leaving, Bossosaurus.
Well, follow them!
Ah!
Thank you for that. That was a dinosaurs reference. Didn't think we were going to make one of those.
That's for exactly 0 of our listeners.
He's kind of funny. He does his job. He's the brunt of a lot of jokes. Basically they have to stop a bunch of crimes. Every time they try to stop a crime, they do something in character. Like David Graff uses his gun more than he needs to do simple things like get a cat out of a tree, that kind of deal.
I laughed like a complete jerk when he shot a cat out of the tree.
The cat's fine, by the way. He like shot the branch.
Yeah, but he's like, I'll get your cat out of the tree, and he pulls out his gun. He's like, oh man, he's gonna shoot the cat. He shot the cat! Holy shit! There's a few new officers at this horrible precinct. Mm-hmm. Most notably, there's Colleen Camp, who plays a very serious gun nut, just like Eugene Tackleberry. Mm-hmm. They're paired up. They fall in love immediately. Colleen Camp is such a damn professional.
Colleen Camp,
she's like Madeline Kahn or Terry Garr or Lucille Ball.
No, here's the problem. Madeline Kahn And Lucille Ball, and who's the other person you mentioned? It was
Terry Garr.
And Terry Garr, they all had big careers.
Yeah.
Some of them won Oscars. Like, they're well, actually, okay, like, fair. They all had big careers. Colleen Camp, I don't understand why Colleen Camp never had a bigger career. She kept being, like, the best part of shitty movies. I think it's the only thing I can think of. Like, Smokey and the Bandit 3. She's great in Smokey and the Bandit 3. The movie stinks. Mm. She's wonderful in it. You probably know her best as Yvette the Maid from Clue, the movie. Mm. She's hilarious in that movie. She was beautiful. She's incredibly funny. Yeah. Very versatile as an actor. But I don't understand why she never had a bigger career. It hurts me.
She kept on working.
She kept on working, but she should have been
hurting for work.
She should have been a major star. Right. She should have been at least as big as...
As Madeline Kahn.
As Kim Cattrall, no, at least. Like, she should have had at least that career. Right. Like, she should have had starring roles in things more,
but,
you know?
But you look her up and you see that she's had quite a long
She had a
career,
long career, and it's a very respectable career. I just don't understand why she wasn't a star.
Okay.
Because she's clearly got the chops.
Yeah. Howard Hessman plays Lessard's brother. Mm-hmm. You've seen Howard Hessman in everything. You'd recognize him.
Mm-hmm. We've got...
And there's Stuhlman. The most disgusting cop in the world.
Okay, this is the part for me where I'm just like...
It's just too gross for you.
He's too gross, and I'm sorry, speaking as someone who is not a thin guy, the walking fat joke character is always insulting and annoying to me. And
well, the joke wasn't that he was fat, it's just that he was a slob.
No. The fatness was considered part and parcel of that. If he was a thin slob, I don't think the joke would have been the same. Mm. If he's a fat slob, because he's always eating. He's picking stuff out of the trash and eating it. Yeah. There's a scene where a cat uses his cereal as a litter box, and he keeps eating it.
Yeah, he fishes the poop out of the bowl, and he keeps eating it.
That's the joke, is that he's a fat slob. And it's the sort of thing that always made me feel really, like, left out. A movie's like, it's like in Star Wars, where you're looking at Star Wars, and everything's like, oh, there's someone for everyone in Star Wars. Mm. Unless you're fat, then we get Jabba the Hutt, or we get Porkins, a guy who's literally named Porkins, and then immediately dies as a fat
I forgot his name. I thought his name was Pork Rinds, but yeah, it's Porkins.
It's the sort of thing that's just like, come on. And he has, and unlike a lot of characters where they have, like, some sort of dignity by the end because their, like, weird quirk is useful later, he doesn't. He's just like a walking fat joke, and then they never talk about him again.
His disgustingness, like, he doesn't grab somebody by the scruff of the neck and, like, breathe his bad breath in their face or something.
That would have been weirdly redeeming. Mm. That would have given him at least a reason to be. Yeah. But he doesn't have that. He's just bad. They just the movie doesn't like him.
Yeah, Stuhlman is only in this one. I'm kind of glad, because the bit where he fishes the cat poop out of his bowl kind of made me barf
a
little bit.
It's really disgusting. Like, it's not funny. It's just gross.
Like, it's the kind of thing that makes you laugh because it's gross, not because it's funny.
Yeah. Anyway, so it all ends in a big to-do where they're fighting Zed, and it's a thing.
Well, the only plot point is that Mahoney is asked to go undercover, and he infiltrates the gang, but they find him out as soon as they get back to the gang's weird, like, their weird Ninja Turtles junkyard lair.
Yeah.
And the police have to infiltrate. There's a big action sequence. The action in these movies is completely compulsory. There's nothing really exciting or high energy about it.
What's weird is they always save the action for the last act, and there's a couple of films where they actually have, like, some helicopter stunts or jet ski stunts or whatever, and they actually, like, put some money into that, so at least there would be a big climax.
Number four, they're fine. Well, yeah, there's balloons and biplanes and stuff.
Yeah, like, they at least tried a little bit to, like, make the end... Because there's no... For the most part in these movies, there's not a lot of forward momentum. In fact, the entire thing is about getting lazy in the middle and just doing one bit after another. So you want to have, like, and now the movie's ending. Mm. So in order to show that the movie's ending, we have to escalate somehow. Yeah. In order to do that, you escalate the level of stunts.
We need to get to 87 minutes. That's something I'll say about these movies. They are all under 90. I think the first one is 94, and the rest are all under an hour and a half. They're in and out real fast.
They know their job.
Don't outstay their welcome. These first two, I recall from when I was a kid, were a lot grittier than the preceding ones, because they got a lot more kid-friendly. The lighting changed. The photography changed.
From Police Academy 3 onwards, they were all PG. PG.
Yeah.
They were all PG-rated films. They were still a little sexy. They were still a little, you know, a lot of gunplay and stuff like that. But it was clearly they understood that although the first two films were raunchy, at this point, their level of humor is for kids.
Their level of humor was for kids, and this was from an era when kids, thanks to cable TV, mm-hmm. started having a lot more wide access to R-rated films.
Yeah.
And they started making cartoon shows of these really violent, gritty R-rated films. Rambo had a cartoon.
RoboCop had a cartoon,
yeah. And Police Academy had a cartoon, because they realized that their audience is actually a lot younger than they intended, so they actually started to cater to who was actually watching it.
What was weird is when they changed the movie franchises to fit. Now, it makes sense to make Police Academy a little kid-friendly, because it's just bumbling cops, or Keystone Cops. That one's fine. But when RoboCop 3 decided to become kid-friendly, and it destroyed the entire tone of the franchise... Yeah.
The horrendous violence is a big part of that series,
yeah, it's a very cynical satire. Yeah, it's a very cynical social satire about the downfall of society in a capitalist system. And now it's about kids who have pet Ed 209s.
Yeah.
No!
And there's like robot ninjas, and there's...
I was fine with the robot ninja. I can handle a robot ninja, but like, yeah.
Your RoboCop is flying around with a jetpack. You'd think it would be like something Paul Verhoeven could have done. That would have been just like something really over the top and schlocky, but no, it's just sort of cheap and not fun.
Anyway, Police Academy 3 back in training. It's PG rated now. And what's weird for me is that the next two films in the Police Academy movies have basically the same plot.
More or less.
Back in Training and then Citizens on Patrol, which case in both of them, there are new guys in Police Academy and the old cadets are back at the school teaching.
Yeah, the old cadets are no longer officers. So we have all of our favorite characters. They're all back. Mahoney's back, Bubba Smith is back, David Graff is back. But yeah, now they are somehow, for some reason, instructors. They're back in training, and some of the characters we've seen before are now entering the police academy for the first time. So Fackler's wife gets a scene where she actually gets to repeat the scene from the first movie, where now Fackler is on the hood of her car while she's on the way to the police academy.
Which I at least appreciated as a shout-out.
They actually kind of did a little mirror. Zed and Sweet Chuck, Bob Goldthwait and Tim Kazurinski, who hate each other and were antagonists in part two, are now roommates because they've both joined the police academy. Yes. He because he's sick of all the gangs, and Zed, I think, because...
He's rehabilitated. He's actually a nice guy now. Yeah. Which I appreciate but that they actually know that like rehabilitation is possible in this universe.
Well, and also, but the funny part is he still acts like Bob Goldthwait.
Yeah, he's still a weird guy, but like he's not evil now.
Yeah.
The basic plot of this one is G.W. Bailey is back. We had Mauser for two films, and now
it's Mauser in part three as well. Oh, is it Mauser in this one? We're on part three. We're not back to four yet.
Oh.
So yeah, Mauser is still the bad guy in this one.
All right.
So we still have Mauser and Lance Kinsey. The idea is Mauser has opened his own police academy.
That's right.
It's really cursory. It's only one scene.
Well, that's why I thought it was G.W. Bailey, because he was the one who actually worked at a police academy. So
So he's opened his own police academy. It's really robotic and serious, and there's a lot of like stern people with clipboards writing down what's being done, and they're sent to Lasard's police academy. George Gaines is still in this, which is now being headed up by Mahoney to sort of prove that these new cadets can do good,
movie. No, the idea is there's only enough money in the budget for one police academy.
Yeah.
So the idea is whichever police academy like produces like the best squad of recruits, that will be the one that they keep.
Yeah.
Either way, a lot of people are going to lose their jobs, and it's sad.
Yeah, but wouldn't you rather it be Mauser's like robots? They're presented as not quite human, the people at his
I guess, family. But at the same time, I don't know if he's incompetent, like, sex addicts and people who think that, like, corruption is cute and whimsical. I don't know if I want them to be police. There's something inherently cynical about the portrayal of the police in these movies as idiots and corrupt. They're either idiots or they're corrupt.
But, so it only makes sense if it's Metropolis, you see.
If you have
idiotic, corrupt cops, that's acceptable in a town where Superman's taking care of the major crimes. But yeah, there's also Brian Tucci.
Yeah.
I like Brian Tucci a lot. I actually think he's a very funny actor. But as I mentioned earlier, he is the butt of every imaginable racist joke you can think of.
Yeah.
I think... Oh, gosh. And he brings as much dignity as he can to this racist caricature. And thank goodness Leslie Easterbrook is there to sort of turn to the camera and say, stop looking at this guy as a racist caricature. He's an attractive man.
I'm taking him seriously, and you should too.
Yeah.
Which is something. I don't know if it's a cure, but it's certainly a Band-Aid on the situation.
It's a Band-Aid on a neck wound, but it's a Band-Aid.
Anyway, they do a bunch of wacky things. None of the bits from this movie have lingered in my brain, and I saw it like a week ago. I couldn't tell you which bit was from this movie and which bit was from another movie.
Just all blending together at this point.
Is this the one with the swimming pool in Leslie Easterbrook, or is that the fourth one?
That's the fourth one.
Yeah, see, this one's gone.
Okay.
This one's completely out of my brain.
Who's going to rescue me? And all the men dive in.
Because it's Leslie Easterbrook.
Because it's Leslie Easterbrook.
Yeah.
There's the bit where they have to kick the door down, and nobody can kick a door down. Because Tim Kantzerinski is like 4'5", he's too small, he kicks the door and he just falls over. Bob Goldthwait runs up to the door and yells at it and it falls over.
All right, that was kind of funny. That was a funny bit. That's kind of funny. Mm-hmm. All right, Bobcat Goldthwait is a funny actor. It all concludes, with the big conclusion of this one is there's a big governor's ball where they're going to announce the winners of the Police Academy thing because we haven't invented entertainment yet. And at the governor's ball, a bunch of, like, thieves with high-powered rifles come in and start robbing everybody, and it turns into a big chase. And, of course, the heroes of our police academy are the ones who are able to fight the bad guys. Never mind where the actual police are. Fortunately, the police academy has got it all under control.
The cadets are
I'm not even sure they're legally allowed to arrest anybody, but here we go.
I'm pretty sure cadets are not allowed to arrest people, but okay. By the way, Metro City or Metropolis or whatever it is played by Toronto, and it's pretty obvious.
I think in the first one it was Los Angeles, so they moved to Toronto because it was cheaper.
Maybe so.
I think in the first one you could recognize some downtown LA bits and stuff.
But in this one there's like Canadian products in the background, and you actually see Toronto's skyline. This is clearly Toronto.
I want to say something we haven't mentioned yet, which is as much as kind of like... crap as this franchise is. I know Whitney is amused by it, but it's cheap, it's tawdry, it's low-hanging, it's not trying very hard.
Yeah.
There is one aspect of these movies that is A-grade, all-time, absolutely brilliant, and that is the score.
Robert Folk composed the theme song to the Police Academy movies, and it is like something out of Patton.
If you told me Jerry Goldsmith like composed this, I would have believed you. Because... this is a great score. It's rousing. It's catchy. Everything about it works.
It opens, with this march. It's a march. There's a snare drum and a piccolo.
Yeah.
And it opens into this big kind of brass band. And it's something that sticks in your head. It gives the films a bit of legitimacy. It's not like, woohoo, wow, it's going to be wacky times.
Like, it's a real score.
This is a police story. And this is a dignified police type of score. And they used Robert Folk's score. He did the score for all of the movies. He did the same theme in all the movies. And it's a good way to get you. It's like the Star Wars theme.
Yeah.
Where you see the Star Wars appear big on the screen and you get in the mood because John Williams' score. Same with the Police Academy movies. Usually it's a glory shot of Toronto, Metro City. And they're playing Robert Folk's scores. They zoom in very slowly into the city. We are being lowered into the world of Police Academy.
Yeah.
Lowered might be the correct word there.
Lowering our expectations, lowering our standards.
But it's actually bringing you in.
Yeah. So, Police Academy 4, Citizens on Patrol.
This is where it kind of falls off for me.
Well, this is the same basic thing, where now there's a whole bunch of new people who are training to be cops. The difference is, they're not training to be cops. They're training to be glorified neighborhood watchmen. But they're also training to be cops. You could have just had them training to be cops.
Some of them are at a police academy. They're going to the police academy to learn police skills.
But they're not going to be cops at the end, but they're learning all the same stuff.
I'm not sure if they're supposed to be deputized, because that would make them police officers, or if they're just busybodies who want to apprehend people. Now that sounds like a horrible moral disaster to me.
Doesn't it?
Just giving police powers to everyone? And giving guns to everyone?
I feel like there's got to be a line somewhere, but anyway.
There's this weird kind of battlefield in the streets mentality, that idea. But this is Lessard's idea. George Gaines is back.
G.W. Bailey is mercifully
and G. W.
back.
G.W. Bailey is back. Mahoney is here, but Steve Guttenberg does not care at this point.
Guttenberg is collecting a paycheck right now.
Yeah.
this is actually the last time we're going to be introduced to some memorable new characters who would actually become parts of, like, the cartoon and become parts of the lore.
Well, there's Mrs. Feldman. I like her.
Mrs. Feldman's funny. She's an old lady who, it turns out, is just like Tackleberry. She's also a big gun nut and military enthusiast. And even though she's a little old lady and, you know, some of the physical requirements of the job lead to... slapstick comedy.
Yeah, she's played by Billy Bird.
She's very funny.
Who is,
she's a very funny actor.
Billy Bird has had a very long career.
Yes, she has.
She was on Dallas in the 1950s.
Wow! That's something. So she's got kind of a funny role. There's a character named House, played by Tab Thacker, who... unlike the fat joke character from Police Academy 2, actually has useful skills.
And well, and they don't.
He's strong as well, and he's like kind of invulnerable. And they treat him like a useful contribution to the team.
He's a big fat guy, but the fat jokes are never at his expense.
Not really.
There's a fat joke in Police Academy 5 where he gets onto one side of a plane and the whole plane tips.
Yeah, but that part was a little unnecessary.
Apart from that, House is seen as a pretty capable officer. And there's a great bit where there's like, how do you do crowd control? Here's a bunch of protesters. You're a cop. How do you...
How do you get the protesters to move back?
How do you get these horrible left-wing protesters? This weird political underpinning to that scene is like, how do you get the protesters to go back? And House, who's just a big guy, just sticks his arms out and says, get back! And starts walking toward them, and they just back up.
Holy shit. Yeah. Andre the Giant and the Princess Bride all over again. Who am I forgetting? Is that it for the new ones? At least all the interesting ones.
Well, there's David Spade.
Oh, yeah, there's David Spade. So we're introduced to a bunch of, like, oh, damn, those skateboarders. Yeah, they're so cool and sexy.
This opens with Robert Fulk's score, but then it immediately segues into a rap song about the movie itself that the characters are actually singing.
Oh, God.
It's a rap song
about
called Citizens on Patrol.
Oh, God.
And we cut to these hip young skateboarders, and one of them is David Spade. Another one of them is Tony Hawk.
No, it's not another one. Tony Hawk is David Spade's stand-in. When David Spade is doing his skateboarding, it's Tony Hawk.
Oh, it's Tony Hawk.
And apparently Tony Hawk was actually quickly fired because he was clearly a foot taller than David Spade. This is David Spade. I think this was his theatrical debut, and it's a big role for a theatrical debut.
And he's good as an asshole kid.
He's fine. Yeah, he's doing his job. And there was actually talk where when Steve Guttenberg left that maybe David Spade would take over as the wacky...
Great.
He probably would have been better than who they ended up getting, but we'll talk about Police Academy 5 in a minute. Much like Mahoney in Police Academy 1, he is given the option of you can either go to jail for being a skateboarder or you can join this Citizens on Patrol. Basically, go to Police Academy.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, I'll do that. And a bunch of wacky hijinks continue to ensue.
They play pranks on people. There's a really hilarious, and when I was a kid, utterly legitimately terrifying bit where some of the younger cadets say, oh, we got this police stuff, and Mahoney Jones and at Hightower decide to play a prank by saying, we got to get you out of bed in the middle of the night. We got to, infiltrate this gang. And they infiltrate the gang, and Bubba Smith is, in this costume, posing as, this sort of, voodoo lord, and they throw a dead body in the back with them, and I didn't understand
what that was supposed to prove.
They're just trying to scare those kids.
It's not really funny. It doesn't really,
scary
like,
to me.
Oh, I forgot. There's one other person in this cast. Sharon Stone.
Oh yeah, Sharon Stone.
Plays a reporter who's just reporting on the Citizens on Patrol program. It would make sense to have her in the program, as a reporter, but she's not. She's just sort of there.
Yeah.
Sharon Stone, who is already probably too good for this. Mm-hmm. She'd already done some starring roles in movies. The story Sharon Stone told was she was getting over a divorce and hanging out with a bunch of comedians sounded good to her.
You know what? God bless everything Sharon Stone does, because she is she seems to be one of the healthiest people.
She seems
Did you read
cool.
that drama how she was kicked off of a dating app?
Yeah, because everyone said that she was impersonating Sharon Stone.
No, I'm Sharon Stone, and I want to use a dating app. And you know what? I bet that dating app got so many single guys signing on all of a sudden. So there's a 1 in 1 zillion chance that I'll land just a date with Sharon Stone.
Well, yes, it's better than I had yesterday.
Yeah, seriously.
I'll try it.
There's also Corinne Borer, who plays Zed's love interest, and she's been in a lot of really wonderful. She's a funny actress who's been in a lot of terrible comedies. She was in stuff like Joysticks and Zapped, and
Joysticks
vice versa.
Is terrible, and so is Zapped.
Yeah.
She's always funny though. She's probably best known to younger audiences as Veronica Mars's mom.
Oh, was she Veronica Mars's mom?
Yeah, it was an important role, but not a role with like a lot of episodes. Yeah. But it was an important role.
She was on ER.
She's a very, very likable, funny actor, and she has a love story with Bobcat Goldthwait, which is just weird. Everything they do is weird. When they realize they like each other, they both have these weird hair whipping moments in slow-mo, and then they run at each other in slow-mo in a park, and then they're like, she's playing like hippie songs on a guitar while he waxes rhapsodic about life, and you're just like, I just want to see a movie about them. They're great. I don't want to see the rest of this piece of crap.
Have you seen any of Bob Goldthwait's stand-up?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
He's funny.
He's hilarious.
He's great, and he's a brilliant director too.
He's done some very good films.
His movie World's Greatest Dad is one of the most complicated stories about grief I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really good film. It's one of Robin Williams' best roles, period. And that's a really odd role as well.
But. Yeah, I didn't see Sleeping Dogs Lie. And he made a really strident film called, I think it was called God Bless America, about just sort of blood revenge in the streets.
Oh, and I forgot. You know what else Corinne Borer was? She was Prank in the live-action Flash series.
That's right, she was. She was the proto-Harley Quinn.
Yeah, before Harley Quinn was created, there was a character just like Harley Quinn who worked for the Trickster, who was also played by Mark Hamill, in the live-action The Flash. And yeah, if you want to go back, and I think they actually ended up bringing her back for like an alternate reality episode of The Flash in like 2018.
Good.
But like, you could go back and watch the original live-action Flash.
Did she beat up Harley Quinn?
I didn't see it.
Oh, that would have been great.
But like, if you go back and watch the original series, you watch it, I'm like, yeah, that's Harley Quinn.
It's 100% Harley Quinn.
It's really funny to me.
The Trickster is kind of like the Joker anyway.
Yeah.
And they gave him his own Harley Quinn, and then they just did that again for Batman the Animated Series with Mark Hamill as the Trickster. And
just wasn't Corinne Borer.
I forgot the name of the actress who played Harley Quinn in the series. But, yeah.
Anyway, Citizens on Patrol. They end up patrolling, and G.W. Bailey is humiliated a lot. How does this one end? Is this the one? This is the one with the hot air balloon.
This is the one with the hot air balloons.
Yeah, bad guys are doing bad guy things, and they try to get away in a hot air balloon. There's actually a couple of cool hot air balloon stunts. Like, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
Like straight up aeronauts, people hanging from a hot air balloon.
This is one of those things where the crime that happens at the end literally happens out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Proctor is in at the jail. Not the prison, just the jail where they're keeping all of the thugs. And they're playing Simon Says, and they're able to get his keys and his gun. And right when G.W. Bailey says, and look at all of the bad guys we've locked up, and Proctor's the only one in the cell, and the bad guys are just sort of out, and they have to chase them all down.
Yeah.
It's just a big prison break. No, it's just a jailbreak.
Well,
just these motorcycle toughs. And they're all wearing those kinds of, stock 1980s criminal outfits.
Vests.
That muggers
always
wore.
There's a lot of vests with pins and chains on them, that kind of thing.
I like to think that there were only three of those outfits, and they had to, like, just sort of go from production to production as, as whatever production needed a thug.
All right. The next film in the series is the one where we lost Gutenberg. Sorry, everybody. There's no more Gutenberg.
We are Gutenberg-less.
What I actually appreciate
is... Which is fine, because in 4, he wasn't there anyway.
I actually appreciate is that Gutenberg left, and he left because he was doing Three Men and a Baby, which admittedly is a better
choice, yeah.
But as a result, Bubba Smith is lead credited here, and I actually think that's cool.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So Police Academy 5, Assignment Miami Beach.
1988.
And this one, Commandant Lassard, who by now is... completely wacky. Everything he's become the new Fackler. Everything he touches turns to disaster. But it's wacky. And I also like how at this point in the franchise, Commandant Lassard's place in the series is everybody loves him. And as a result, they're just trying to protect him. They're trying to protect his feelings. They're trying to protect his job. And at the start
trying
of it...
Trying to protect his goldfish.
At the start of it...
We haven't mentioned the goldfish
yet. Oh, yeah. He's got a goldfish that is always ill-fated. At the start of the film, G.W. Bailey and Proctor... they find out that Commandant Lassard is actually 1 year over the mandatory retirement age. And as a result, he's got to retire. But this happens to coincide with him receiving an award for the best police officer of the decade for the whole country. which I don't quite buy, but okay, let's just run with this. And that, of course, is in Miami Beach. There's actually a bit I like in this. Where G.W. Bailey is like, well, Commandant Lassard is gone. I guess I'll take his job. And someone points out to him, you know why Commandant Lassard, even though he's wildly incompetent, is good at his job and you're not? He actually has the respect of the people who work for him. And G.W. Bailey's like, well, now shit, you're right, actually. I might actually be able to turn a corner here and become a better person. And so he decides for the entire movie to be a decent guy. And of course he fucks it up because he's inherently a jerk. But I actually appreciate that that's actually a plot in one of these.
I appreciate that they set that up, but I feel I don't like what they do to the character, because we get to see that he's just as much a dick in his private life as he is as a cop.
Did you think he wasn't? Did you think he was wonderful at home with his kids?
I was kind of hoping that, you know, he just, okay, yeah, he's really mean, but we keep him around because he's an efficient police officer. Like, there's a reason to have him around other than just to abuse him. It turns out, no, we're just here to abuse him. And he suffers the worst indignities in, well, I mean, he had his head up a horse's butt in one of the earlier ones, but he's pretty badly insulted in part five as well.
He has dork written on his chest gets his head on fire.
He tries to flirt with women in the worst possible way, and they always really slap him across the face. He's just such a horrible human being.
I'm gonna say this right now. The MVP of the entire franchise is G.W. Bailey.
That's fair.
G.W. Bailey, he's in 5 out of 7 of these things. There's only a few people who've been in more. But unlike the other people who are in all of them or most, he never has a moment of dignity. Not a single moment in which his character is afforded dignity, or grace, or good humor, or love, or the respect of anyone except for maybe Proctor. And even that I don't really buy. I think he's just a kiss-ass. And he always throws himself into it. He never half-asses it. No matter what he's doing, no matter what horrific, shameful thing the Police Academy movies demanded of G.W. Bailey, he did it, and he did it with enthusiasm. And I respect
that. He is 100% professional. And
I respect that.
I feel that way about most of the regular cast members. David Graff and Leslie Easterbrook I have endless respect for because they were completely committed to these roles. They created some interesting comic creations that have, like it or not, kind of stayed in your mind. You know who Callahan, Tackleberry, and Lieutenant or Captain Harris are. So I have endless respect. No matter how low these movies got, they stayed up.
Yeah, they committed. Anyway, so the plot of this one, they go to Miami Beach, but wouldn't you know it, there was a diamond heist that was run by the recently departed and ever so wonderful character actor Rene Aubergenois. Who you may know him from MASH, you may know him from Beyond Westworld, you may know him from Deep Space Nine. You probably don't know him from Beyond Westworld, but he was in a show called Beyond Westworld.
He played a character named Power.
With Rene Aubergenois as Power.
I took a picture of his credit. It's like, and it's over a nuclear power plant, like his credit. It says, with Rene Aubergenois as Power. And I took a picture of it and said, hey, look, Rene Aubergenois as Power. And Rene Aubergenois saw it.
And he tweeted at you.
And he tweeted at me. He's like, what is that from? I don't remember. Like, remember you were on Beyond Westworld? Oh, yeah, I remember that. He worked a lot. He doesn't remember every job.
His IMDb filmography is nuts. So I don't blame him for one second for forgetting he was on Beyond Westworld.
A single episode of this forgotten show.
Probably on the show for 4 days 1981. I don't blame him at all. He's stolen a bunch of diamonds, and they're in a suitcase. But wouldn't you know it, it looks just like Commandant Lassard's suitcase. There's a mix-up at the airport. They switch suitcases, and now he has to do everything he can to get the diamonds back before the guy who hired him to steal the diamonds kills him.
Rene Aubergenois is great. He plays a tough guy well, but sort of a panicky tough guy.
Well, yeah, because he's actually like screwed. He's not really villainous here. So
one of his sidekicks is played by Archie Hahn.
That's true.
Stand-up comedian Archie Hahn.
So he's desperately trying to steal this bag back from Commandant Lassard. Then he does, but it turns out Commandant Lassard has already removed it, and all the diamonds are hidden in a video camera.
Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, so there's a bit. And there's a thing that a lot of the Police Academy movies don't do. That I will say this about Police Academy 5. They do this. They set up the joke, before we get to the punchline.
There's actually setup and payoff.
Yeah, a lot of the Police Academy movies, it's basically just like, excuse me, officer, this man refuses to stop smoking and there's no smoking area.
I'm going to shoot your cigar, mister.
That's it. Yeah. There's no setup, there's no buildup, there's no twist. It's just everything you think is going to happen is going to happen. Here, it's actually like, okay, so we've set up all of these wacky shenanigans, and they're all going to go down in slightly unexpected ways. There's actually some decent gags in this one.
The gags aren't funny. I don't like Matt McCoy, who is kind of the Mahoney replacement, because he has no personality whatsoever.
Yeah, it's like Lassard's nephew. He's basically played... generic hunky dude, and he's played by Matt McCoy, who probably.
I remember him from L.A. Confidential, actually.
I think most people remember him best from L.A. Confidential. He was the star of the fake Dragnet TV series.
He's Badge of Honor.
He's a really good actor, actually. He was in a really good low-budget horror movie that I like called Abominable, which is basically Rear Window, but instead of the protagonist seeing out his back window like a murder, he sees people being killed by a Yeti. And so no one believes him that they're being attacked by a Yeti. Would you? So he's really in a bad spot, and it's a surprisingly suspenseful and well-made film. So he does the same thing Mahoney does, where he basically sexually harasses someone, and then she immediately falls for him anyway.
And she's somebody notable, too. She is played by, let me look up her name because I totally forgot what it was, Janet Jones.
Okay.
You know Janet Jones because she is Wayne Gretzky's wife.
Why would I know that?
Because they made a big deal of it on Wayne's World a lot. Because Mike Myers is from Canada, and he's really into hockey, so he brought that into all of his characters. And remember when he played himself in The Love Guru as a hockey enthusiast?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he got Wayne Gretzky on Saturday Night Live, and of course they had to involve his hot wife, because she was also a model.
Yeah.
Yeah, she plays an officer. She's also a martial arts expert.
There's a scene in the movie.
They have a romance. It's the most boring thing.
She's teaching a bunch of people like self defense, and she gets to fight Jonesy, who's a martial arts master. Mm. But she's teaching it right next to a giant cactus. And I'm like, I don't care if you
somebody's crotch is going on that cactus.
Like, listen, I don't care if you're in a comedy or not. You don't practice like martial arts next to a cactus. Are you stupid? It was a terrible idea. You're just asking for it. Like, what the hell? The climax of this movie, I think, is the best climax in all the Police Academy movies, because it actually is a good joke.
Well, the good joke is that at this big event that Lassard has coming to attend, there is always some sort of police demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't been made savvy as to what the demonstration is going to be, so when Rene Auberjonois and Archie Hahn and the other guy come to kidnap him, he thinks it's all staged, so he's actually very polite and is giving them advice throughout.
Like, no, you don't want them to send you a car, you want them to send you a helicopter. We're right next to the roof. It makes no sense otherwise. And when Amber was like, thanks, man.
Right.
This guy's great.
And when his boss says, okay, you got to cack the old man, he's like, not the old man. Come on, he's been so nice. You got to kill the hostages. I can't kill this hostage.
Yeah, this guy was great.
I don't mind killing Harris. He's an asshole.
Right, right. All of that bit with Commandant Lassard making the kidnappers better and making it harder for him to be rescued. That's a setup. They're constantly finding new ways around that bit. Gaines is actually funnier than I think he's ever been, because he's finally getting like time to be funny. He's not just in for one joke. He's got a whole movie kind of built around him. I'm going to say this right now. I think this is the best one.
Really?
That's a low bar.
This is the worst one. This one. Oh my god.
This one hits a really impressive 2 stars. For me, this is a 2-star movie. And I'm like, you know what? Bless you, because this is a real film. This is not a great film. It's not even a particularly good film, but it's a real film with actual thought that went into the jokes, and there's actually some humor in it, and I don't hate the people who made it, and it's not all super mean-spirited. I actually don't, because here's why, and I think this really comes into play in the next one, Police Academy 6.
City Under Siege.
City Under Siege. I think that with Police Academy 5 and Police Academy 6 in particular, I think they found the sweet spot in the series, which is these are Mad Magazine movies. Police Academy 6 is a Mad Magazine movie.
That's 1, 2, and 3. It's all the chaos and mean-spiritedness from Mad Magazine.
There's no, like, broadness to it. There's no archness to it in the terms of the storytelling.
There's no broadness to it?
No, in terms of the jokes. Okay. I'm talking about in terms of the storytelling. Don't they hit Police Academy 6? Then they're in this kind of cartoon world where there's a big shadowy guy with a bunch of, like, underlings who play practical jokes on him. He says, good on you. That was a good joke. Joke's on me. Exploding cigar. Ha, 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 ha. Like, we're starting to hit this very campy tone that I think is actually the best tone for a Police Academy movie. To just lean into the silliness. Mm. Not the profanity. Not the insult comedy. The silliness. To make it more like a silent comedy.
If you're not going to use the excuse to be at least somewhat profane, what's the point?
The point is to be silly. All
right.
You've got all of these broad archetypes. I just want to see them be silly.
I think the formula is old by now. I think all of the characters, even the new ones, are just sort of checked out. The new Mahoney character does not have any wit, humor, or charm to him whatsoever.
He's not even the protagonist in this one. No. They gave up on him. He's in it, but he's not important anymore.
No, I think all of the returning characters are just sort of sleepwalking through all the material. I think it's all an excuse to be really cruel to Harris, and none of those gags are funny.
Mm.
I was trying to find, like, overviews of the Police Academy series online that weren't written by me. And
was it difficult?
It was difficult. And I was looking on Rotten Tomatoes. This has no positive reviews. Gene said all the critics hated it, and rightly so, because there is just no wit or energy. That they followed a basic screenplay structure doesn't impress me.
It's not just the screenplay structure. Right. It's the look of the movie. It's the tone of the movie. It's that it starts feeling a bit more Naked Gun-like. And I think I just sort of responded to it just taking place in this cartoon world where it's like an adjunct to Dick Tracy now. And I think I kind of like that.
And number 5 was that was the same year as Naked Gun.
One of them, yeah.
It was, 89.
Anyway.
So part 6 was the same year as The Naked Gun.
Yeah. So anyway, City Under Siege, there is a whole crime wave that is being perpetrated by a mysterious shadowy figure whose will shall be done by Garrett Graham.
Yeah.
The great character actor Garrett Graham, who I think you've seen, but you probably know him best from something like Phantom of the Paradise, which we've covered on the Two Shot before because it's brilliant. They're just stealing everything left and right, and they don't know why or what rhyme or reason it is. It's a whole crime wave.
And there's a new mayor, and he's played by Kenneth Mars, a Mel Brooks graduate. He played he was in the producers, and he played the wooden-armed guy from Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, funny actor. Mm. G.W. Bailey was the captain of the police precinct, and in the middle of a stakeout,
he gets so distracted by Proctor and so distracted by his own ego, about how great he's going to be that he misses a robbery happening right next to
him. Like, literally right in front of him, and as a result, he is shamed and humiliated, and the governor brings in Commandant Lassard and his team of specialists, who is basically whoever we can get from the old cast now. Fackler's back.
Couldn't have gotten Julie Brown back. She was in part 2, like for a scene.
Yeah, but she was all she was the police seamstress.
Yeah.
That's it.
Get her back. Have her be part of the police academy.
She'd be fine. I'd be fine. So they bring Commandant Lassard back, and G.W. Bailey's, of course, humiliated, and he doesn't want any part of it. And they're all trying to solve a crime wave. Mm-hmm. That's it. Everything is about them trying to solve a crime wave. Fackler, you mentioned this already. Mm-hmm. Fackler is back. He took a couple films off because he wanted too much money. apparently, that's true. Mm-hmm. And he comes back when they announce that Fackler's back.
The actor is named Bruce Mahler, to give him full credit. But yeah.
When they announce that Fackler is back, we get a long scene of him walking through the police precinct, and everything he touches becomes a domino effect of disaster.
It's... I love the bit because it feels like an old silent movie bit.
Yeah.
I compared to Harold Lloyd just because he looks like Harold Lloyd. He's got the little round glasses and he has that kind of nerdy appearance, but he also is really accident prone. He's a bit of a klutz. And he walks just this really brief sequence where he walks through the office and everything catches on fire. Literally. Like, he actually sets off a box of fireworks indoors just by walking through. And that is actually paid off later on when he goes to make the same walk and they use the same set of shots, but instead of everything being knocked over and destroyed, everyone is diving out of his way and they end up causing almost as much chaos just getting out of his way than he would himself. Like, they're, like, moving coffee mugs out of his way and dodging things that he's swinging around. It's really, really hilarious.
Yeah.
It is a sublime comedic set piece.
The movie continues apace. Everyone gets their bits.
Well, and the thugs are all that are in under the charge of this mysterious mastermind that we only see in shadow have sort of mirrors in members of Police Academy.
Mm.
So there's a gun nut. Garrett Graham plays the gun nut, so he and Tackleberry can have a scene together.
Yeah, because
there's a really big guy named Ox, and he and Bubba Smith have a scene together.
Yeah, yeah. It all basically leads to. I actually like the climax of this one fine because everyone gets something to do.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's special skills come into play as they are forced to break off and deal with. Again, it feels like a comic book. Like, they're all like, okay, so everyone in the X-Men has a Brotherhood of Evil Mutant to fight at the end. And they do. And everyone's got, like, a superpower.
Jonesy has to distract a crowd at one bit. And they, in the most transparent thing imaginable, just give him a stand-up bit in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
Where he just stands up in front of a mic under a spot lamp and just does a stand-up routine.
Yeah.
The movie stops for that.
Anyway, again, this is another one where it's lowbrow humor, but it's not super insulting humor. Mm-hmm. It feels like a real movie. I actually like the way it's shot. I think it's shot like in this very cartoonish Dick Tracy-ish kind of way, and I actually just responded to that. I don't hate this movie. I know I'm supposed to hate this movie. Leonard Maltin's quoted as when he wrote this. I'm sorry. No, not Leonard Maltin. Pete Hammond for Leonard Maltin's movie guide.
Oh, okay.
Wrote that this entry is only, repeat, only for those who thought Police Academy 5 was robbed at Oscar time.
It's a good quote.
It's a good quote, damn it. And I get it. I do. Mm-hmm. Maybe we've hit that, like, line where you've watched so many Police Academy movies that, like...
They're kind of growing on you after a while.
They're not growing on me. I appreciate that the things that I hated aren't there anymore.
Okay.
So, like, this is...
When they do something even vaguely competent or capable, you start latching onto that one thing.
I just think it's better than the others. So I think 5 and 6 are... okay-ish.
I would show
them to kids and they'd be fine.
As somebody who actually has a deep affection for the Police Academy movies, I think they're worn out by this point. They're done. And Police Academy 7 was maybe one of the greatest miscalculations in the history of series comedy.
Okay, Police Academy 7 does suck.
Why on earth do we need to come back in the mid-90s with a 7th Police Academy movie? This is this weird nostalgia grab for something that had always been derided.
Yep.
And is trying to cash in on what little nostalgia they have. They clearly have a really, really, really low budget. Mm-hmm. It looks like it.
The budget was $10 million. Guess how much it made domestically?
Six.
$126,247.
I was barely released. This was one of those movies I missed because I was overseas. I probably would have seen it in theaters. I missed The Lion King, I missed The Flintstones, and I missed Police Academy 7.
Yeah.
Big, important movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if I were in the country, I would have sort of seen it come and go. As it stands, I only knew that it was coming, and by the time I got back to America, it was gone.
Yeah.
So it came out in 94. The idea is...
There's a crime wave in Moscow.
And we need to get our usual gang together to go to Moscow, and they shoot in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And they take care of stuff.
And they... Turns out the guy who's running the police force, you'd think he'd be the villain.
Mm.
The guy who's running the police force is Christopher Lee. And his only joke is he keeps trying to kiss Commandant Lassard. Mm. That's it. It's his whole joke. Literally, the last shot in any Police Academy movie is Christopher Lee kissing Commandant Lassard.
Right on the face.
Christopher Lee's got a very handsome mustache.
Big handlebar mustache.
I appreciate it. But that's it. Mm-hmm. They go to Moscow. They're gonna try to catch Ron Perlman, who's in the middle of a crime wave involving Game Boy video games. And this is right around Tetris is popular. We'd better show that that's like Russian insidious influence.
Really, really overwhelmingly popular at the time.
Yeah.
Trying to cash in on the kid market. Hey, look, if the wizard can do it, we can.
Mm-hmm. Remember when Surf Ninjas tried to make a Game Gear magic? Like,
that's
literally
right.
Magical Game Gear.
Sega Game Gear. This is something that bugged every kid who saw films that featured Game Boys. Because they got actual Nintendo Game Boys, but they couldn't show the brand name, so you could only ever see them from the back. The problem is you loaded the game cartridge into the back, and they never actually bothered to insert cartridges when they put them in movies. So the Game Boys were always empty.
Yeah, and at the beginning of the movie, like it cuts to like a bunch of people like on the news, and one of them's playing with a Game Boy. And there's no cartridge in it. Mm. Later, they try to take the curse off it. I think someone noticed because there's a cartridge in the back, but the cartridge has been blacked out in Sharpie. It's really embarrassing. It's so weird to me how like video games are not this weird thing that no one does, but so many movies have no concept of how people play video games. Well, watch the Book of Henry sometime.
You say people, and you know, in the late 80s, it was. Thanks to Nintendo, who marketed to kids, it was a kids' market.
But this is 1994. Video games, they could have, people had kids. People
who
knew kids.
Who's making Police Academy 7? Not a new generation of people. It's
immature
the same old
people, who probably
yeah.
play Game Boy. Like, but again, like you watch something like Book of Henry, where like a big weird subplot is Naomi Watts playing video games, and she's playing video games like she's only ever seen people play video games in 1980s commercials.
She's just sort of banging the buttons
and really
yeah.
exaggerating every movement. Mm. Like, that's not how someone who actually knows how to play Gears of War plays Gears of War.
That's how somebody who's just starting how to play video games
maybe
plays, but yeah.
But yeah, but the whole point is her character loves video games. No, I don't buy it. That's not a thing. People think that's actually actually a way to play video games that I would make you worse at the game.
The problem is watching somebody else play video games is like the least cinematic thing imaginable.
I know,
so
but like
it's difficult to film, and they're trying to. It's
but
like
you
in the
about
movie.
It.
We talked about this when we did our bumping the mic when we talked on our commentary for the movie Hackers.
Yeah.
How do you make cinematic just somebody sitting at a keyboard hacking into a system? Turns out Ian Softley, the director of that film, found the most outlandish way to film that sort of thing, by projecting things on people's faces and tilting the camera and having these big abstract montages within the computer brain. There's a montage where they get in their in phone booths hacking into computers, so they have this big musical sequence where the phone booths are rotating and the camera's spinning around. They're trying to make hacking look interesting, and I think that film succeeded.
Well, fair enough, but this is a movie where people play video games just sort of idly in the background. Mm. Just put a cartridge in there and have them press the buttons. You would have been a lot easier than what you actually did. Mm. Anyway. So there's Ron Perlman starting a crime wave. So I'm vaguely aware of how the video games
do. He's hiding some kind of criminal thing inside the video game software. He's trying to hack into American systems because Russians would, I mean, what an outlandish story. Russians would never play with American politics at all. Okay, it's a very prescient movie.
Okay, I take it all back. Mission to Moscow is the most important movie of the 1990s.
Indeed. There's a new.
If only we'd listened.
Matt McCoy is back as the Mahoney stand, and he's just as boring as ever.
Wait, is Matt McCoy even in this one?
Yeah, he's in it. I think so.
Is Matt McCoy? No, he's not.
I thought Matt McCoy was in this.
No,
one.
That's how little of an impression Matt McCoy makes.
God, all
they
right.
didn't even put him in this one.
But they do have a new Matt McCoy type. Who's like the young. He's the cadet.
Charlie Schlatter is a police cadet who gets himself invited onto the mission, and he has a really awkward romance with a young Claire Forlani.
I remember the 3 or 4 years Claire Forlani was a big Hollywood presence.
Remember them?
I think she's fine. I have nothing
against
Claire
Forlani. Like, she didn't have a big career.
Yeah, she was in Mallrats, she was in Meet Joe Black, she was in Mystery Men. She's a fine actress, but she just
never
took off and was mocked a lot. I don't understand why people didn't like hated Claire Forlani.
I can't think of a reason why. She does nothing wrong here. But there's a scene where G.W. Bailey has to be in a ballet.
There's a scene where G.W. Bailey tries to spy on somebody and gets dog pee in his eye. Looks through a tube and a dog pees down the tube.
Again, if we
want
to give G.W. Bailey an honorary Oscar for the Police Academy movies, I think he earned it.
It would be posthumous at this point, but
no,
yeah.
He's alive!
Oh, yeah, you're right. George Gaines is the one who died.
Yeah, yeah. What's the point? Several people have died, man. No, G.W. Bailey is alive.
David Graff has also passed away. Yeah. Okay, give him an honorary Oscar.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that.
You can put a little police hat on it. It'll be funny.
Thank you for... This goes to every comedian who got dog pee in their eye. trying to advance their careers.
You know what? Mm. That would be a very moving speech for a lot of comedians.
I think you're right.
I think a lot of people would be like, thank you.
Every comedy needs somebody who gets horrendously humiliated. I'm glad I could be that guy for five goddamn movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, good for him. There's a really bizarre scene where Lassard... He goes on. I think he goes on a different plane. He gets separated from.
He's supposed to go. They tell him.
Five. They get on the wrong plane.
No. In seven, they get off the plane to Moscow, and the person in charge of all the inter-country relations, Lassard asks, "Oh, which car is mine?" And he says, "Oh, the one at the front of the convoy." Mm. And he goes to the one at the front, but it turns out that's actually a different person's car.
So he just gets in some guy's car.
Yeah, and then he ends up being sort of adopted by the family and going to a family funeral, and no one speaks the language, and they all just think he's this charming old man. And
there's a weird, really bizarre scene where they spit eggs at each other.
Yeah, I don't understand that at all.
Like, he swallows a whole egg, and then he spits it out, and it lands, like,
in another guy's mouth,
and they just spit it back and forth between their mouths, and that's got to be someone's fetish, I think.
I don't understand that at all.
Yeah.
So he's out for a lot of it, and everyone else trying to solve the crime. Leslie Easterbrook ends up doing a lot of the heavy lifting in this one. She ends up going undercover as Ron Perlman's new girlfriend.
She gets to sing.
She's great.
This one, yeah.
She's good. And then it's over. And that's the Police Academy franchise.
The series had been petering out since at least the first third of Police Academy 4. All right? It kind of hit its heights with part 3.
And then it just kind of sauntered
vaguely downward into lazier and lazier jokes that were less and less funny as you went. These people, they're affable.
Mm.
Except for part 5. I think part 5 is toxic. But they're generally pretty approachable movies. And... affable is not the same thing as funny. It's not the same thing as having energy or actual comedy.
Well, if they'd had any comedy in the first couple of films, I would have agreed with you. But instead, I'll take affable.
All right.
Like, Bobcat Goldthwait kept two of them alive. The rest of them, not so much.
And I'm talking to somebody who hates the movie Animal House. I usually don't like that kind of slobs versus snobs chaos comedy. But for some reason, Police Academy got under my skin.
Oh, I forgot. Someone pointed this out to me. I looked it up. Apparently, it's true. There's a scene in the movie where Michael Winslow in Mission to Moscow does his sound effects shtick through a police radio. The frequency they were on was the actual military radio, so everyone, the entire Russian military had to hear Michael Winslow's shtick
during the filming.
Yeah, like his wireless microphone, in all of his scenes, was
tuned to the military.
So everyone just heard Michael Winslow. No one decided to change the frequency.
Oh,
I don't know.
Can you imagine being in Russia at the time? Now, this was Russia in 1994. This was only a few years after the coup. Yeah. They were like the Soviet Union just a few years prior, and they went to film in St. Petersburg. And the country was still sort of rebuilding. I was in Russia that year, in 1994, and there was still a lot of scarcity. The money situation hadn't really worked itself out, so the ruble was just booming. We were Americans, so we actually had dollars, and they took American dollars everywhere because that's hard currency. They can actually, use that. Every restaurant, every store had their own exchange rate. So, you go to the exchange window, you get a good exchange rate. You go to Pizza Hut, you got a crappy exchange rate. Oh, God. So you end up paying 60 American dollars for a single pizza. But this kind of idea that it was this well-organized spy machine is such a dated concept, even as early as 1994. This isn't the Soviet Union any longer.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie Sneakers, which came out in 1992, there's this idea that the coup just happened. It's the Commonwealth of Independent States. We're not really sure what we're going to do politically yet. It takes place in this weird kind of political dead zone for Russia. And that movie got a lot of political traction from that. This movie has no politics on its mind whatsoever. It's based on an old idea. It was clearly written when the Soviet Union was still a thing and they just kept the script. It has no actual funny jokes. It's just lazy and cheap, and it feels like everybody is sleepwalking through the whole thing.
Mm.
I don't like it.
I'm not going to claim it's a good movie. Yeah. So that is it for the Police Academy movies, and that is it for The Two Shot.
Good night, sweet Two-Shot, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest.
It's been a real great trip. I just want to thank everybody, everybody from the Old Schmoes Know Network, everybody from the Movie House Network, which we have now become, for giving us a home for this podcast and our other podcasts as well. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We hope you follow us if you haven't already. We hope you follow us over to the Critically Acclaimed Network. That's where you can find it on iTunes and other podcasty places.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's the Apple podcast.
It's not called iTunes. Yeah, iTunes
Apple
was
music
it was split into three different things of music podcasts, and I think audiobooks or something are all different now.
Well, in any case, you can find us there.
On the Apple Podcast Network.
Yeah. Critically Acclaimed Network. You can find our movie reviews on Critically Acclaimed. We answer all your emails, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. You can, by all means, ask us about the Two-Shot over at We've Got Mail. We review TV shows that lasted only one season or less at Canceled Too Soon. And pretty soon at our still-to-be-named, but we're narrowing it down, Star Wars podcast, we're going to be looking at the really varied and a fascinating group of films that gave us Star Wars. And we hope you enjoy that as much as we are enjoying planning it out. We've already got like a short list of films we want to cover, and it's really weird, exciting group of films, and we're very, very excited
about it. We finally get to go into sort of the deep dive and actual research, which is something that not a lot of critics get to do, so it's going to be really exciting.
Thank you, everybody, for supporting us. Thank you, everybody, for following us on Twitter. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
Together we are at Critic Acclaim. And again, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork for varying amounts of monthly contributions. You get to vote for future episodes of our shows. You get bonus content, reviews of TV movies, reviews of Star Trek episodes, reviews of Oscar-nominated Best Pictures. We're doing every single nominee in chronological order over there. It's been a hell of a dive. Really exciting stuff. We're doing more commentary tracks. It's a lot of cool stuff. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And bye.